Welcome or welcome back. My name is Noelle, aka the Puerto Rican Princess of Podcasting, and I'm here with my co-host,
Jaden, aka the Fashion Boy of the World.
And this is
Sample Spice Podcast.
Allegedly.
No. We really don't know.
We don't know. No, this is Sample Size Podcast.
Yes. Cheers. And we're back.
Applaud. Insert applaud. Bam, music. Bam.
Hot 97. Here we are.
We've been gone for a minute now. Back with the jump off. Oh, I don't know the rest of the lyrics.
Neither do I. I was just going to let you go and I'm going to pretend I know what it is.
No, I'm a Nicki Minaj stan. I'm sorry.
Literally, anyone who might be watching a video, if there's a video of this right now, I'm nodding like I know what I'm doing, but I don't.
I'm a converted Barb.
Don't converted.
I mean, what does it do?
Former? Yeah.
I feel like I hung my jersey up.
I did. I feel like you, if you play like Nicki in the club or somewhere, I'm going to be standing up on something, of course.
But
do I follow her on Twitter or Instagram? No.
No. It's not for me anymore.
I can't do it. Okay. We are back. 2023. Yeah. Here we are.
We're back. Now that we have our Nicki Minaj slander out the way, we can start this new episode. Oh my God.
Okay. First, how are you doing, Noelle?
Honestly, this is like very surreal to me, so I'm just taking in this moment. You know, we've been planning and plotting and, you know, prepping all of the P words, getting ready to do this show, and I'm just glad to be here.
How are you, friend? This feels really amazing. We went on hiatus. That's mm-hmm. what I've been calling it. So 2022, most of it, we weren't recording. We weren't doing much of fashion, even like online, social media.
Paying attention. Not even really logging into social media, at least on my end.
I would go like once or twice a day. And then I'd be like, what are you talking about? And then I realized I didn't want to talk with anyone. So I'll log out.
Yep.
But there was a couple things I feel like this year that as I'm looking back, I just have to bring up. Like a little quick little like 2022 check-in.
Yeah, it only feels right that we start out this new season reflecting on the past year because, you know, 2022 has been a year.
It has been quite
the year. Yes. I would say it's been like a transformative year, at least on a personal level, which is probably why like I just haven't been paying attention to fashion as much. But I'm excited to see what bag of tricks you pull out for me today.
Oh, I agree. This year, there's a lot of like personal grief, personal change. But I realized I'm ready to come back. Like, y'all need to hear what we have to talk about. Even if you don't want to, you're going to hear it. So first, on a positive note, some things I loved this year. I have to go. My stan card is still clocked in on my boy, Glenn Martens.
Okay,
my
wait.
King.
Pause.
Yeah.
I think we should like introduce what we're doing first.
Oh, yes. Tea.
Yeah. Okay. So is there a there's no pause. I wish you could pause.
There is a pause. Okay, we're back.
Alrighty, so we have been gone for quite a while. If you haven't noticed, your podcast feed being slightly empty and less fashionable. But honestly, 2022 was a very difficult year. Like, I know for me personally, I went through a ton of stuff. Jaden went through a ton of stuff. So I feel like before we start out this new season of Sample Size Podcast, we just want to take a moment to like reflect and kind of, you know, embrace the moment a little bit. So give me the 411, Jaden. Like what was happening? If you remember anything.
Honestly, this year feels like it was 12 years long all into one because so much is packing all together. I had some personal medical issues I was going through. I had some grief. I lost my father at the almost end of the summer in August. I didn't know if I was going to say that, actually. I thought maybe I'd just be like, was going to keep
listen,
it.
Listen, this is like my diary. This is my therapy. I'm planning on being a more open book, yes. I guess, and kind of letting it out on this platform. And honestly, editors know if you want to cut it, we can cut it.
Yeah.
We can do that segment again if you want to.
I think I'm going to keep it, actually. Because one thing about myself, I am very, like, guarded. And sometimes I, like, keep things in. But I'm realizing it's okay to be more open and discuss what's going on. Because that was hell, especially with, you know, things happening before that. He passed away from cancer. So he was diagnosed in April. So it was kind of quick. So that definitely made the year even worse. But through that and through my own, like, medical issues, I think I found a little more determination and some strength in that. And I kind of surprised myself the way I'm still standing at the end of this.
So, yeah.
I'm proud of myself a little bit. Just a little bit.
I'm so, like, unbelievably, like, proud of you for just shouldering all of the shit that you did. And honestly, I feel like 2022 was shit for everyone, but on some cosmic level, I feel like it was just like extra shitty for us.
Oh, and
like weird parallel ways, but kind of like, I feel like almost like the fact that we were both going through our own things, like individually and together, really did help me through the year. And like, being able to kind of like centralize our focus on this project and relaunching Sample Size genuinely got me through some of like the worst times this year, because 100%. Lord knows, like, me and the fucking United States healthcare insurance system were going through it. And yeah, first of all, big F you to the fucking United States insurance medical system. Fuck y'all. Y'all are evil. We need to just
literally
it. Like, yeah, because like 2020 for me, I basically like got really, really depressed, and really, really sick.
Yeah.
And had to kind of face the reality of like, okay, you've been the strong person your entire life, and I've been kind of like almost on like survival mode my whole entire life. And it got to the point where it just felt extremely overwhelming, and like almost like I couldn't hold all of like the responsibilities. I couldn't like be a good friend. Like, I couldn't be present in the things that I had enjoyed previously because I was just holding on to so much like anxiety and like depression, honestly. And it came to kind of like a little bit of like, you know, a breaking point or whatever, but I was able to kind of just like step back from social media, step back from everything, reset. And I'm kind of like actively in the process of learning how to take care of myself.
Yeah.
And that's
the hardest thing, I would say, that you and I both struggle with, but you and I twin.
2020 vision, bitch, we twin.
Literally. But having you on my side has been really important. And one thing about Noelle and I, we get together, we talk, and we cry. So, like, I'm trying not to cry right now, because one thing about us, we will sit on Noelle's couch and cry.
Baby, I will sit on my couch and get high and cry. I mean, y'all want to know what I was really doing 22? Crying. I was crying, smoking, journaling, and yoga-ing. That's it. Trying to preserve my sanity.
I was under my covers, like, just laying in bed. I mean, like, I have to get up because I have to. I was like, life continues. Mm-hmm. But I'm realizing and still trying to realize, and, you know, therapy starts tomorrow. I need to do a little more than just forcing myself to keep going. I need to, like, look at my emotions a little bit more.
Yeah. But
I'm proud of that.
Because, you know, that's how I am. It's if I can follow a routine, I will follow it until I don't have it anymore. 100%. But I realized that, like, okay, yeah, you can have a routine. Yeah, you can be, you know, a really effective person. I would say that I'm like a very like a what is the term where you're like a high achieving depressive or like a highly functioning depressed person. Whatever that whatever that terminology, that's me to a point. But once you hit your breaking point, I didn't have the trampoline of like self-care or like even community because I had so deeply isolated myself. Mm-hmm. Which is honestly like my other biggest takeaway of 2022 is just the importance of community and friendship.
Yeah, and I found some people I was shown the people who were already there how important they were, and let's not get into that. But
bitch, no shit. Yeah. The people that I'm closest to are the people that were with me through the pandemic. Yeah. Like literally. Yeah. I mean, you and like if you think about like our whole little fashion friend group, like. Yeah. Those are the people who I was still able to like find some type of joy and community through the appreciation of this art. And again, which is why I feel like sample size really did help me get through this year, even though we weren't working on it. I knew like we still have so much community building to do. So not even to be, why are we being so cheesy and corny?
I don't even think it's corny. Like
we're
giving NPR
right now. I love literally, it. Literally,
like I'm ready to put like a Better Health like ad at the end of this or something.
Oh yeah, use a discount code size for 20% off.
Size.
I think that should be our discount code. I think it should be size.
That's size. Hilarious. Just size.
20% off your next HelloFresh meal kit.
Literally, smash. Don't say the name yet. They haven't paid us nothing.
Right. Manifesting.
Alana, do the homeless like Prada?
Yes, queen!
And we are back and ready to talk about our main topic. So as you can tell by the episode title, this week we will be discussing Coco Chanel's origins and her ties to Nazi Germany, which is kind of a departure from what we did in season one, where we were more focused on kind of current events and pop culture. I think the big change for season two and in the direction we're trying to move towards is to be more focused on kind of the underlying issues that are going on in society today and how they tie into the fashion industry. So, for example, over the last couple of months in 2020, we've seen the rise of a lot of just really ugly sentiments like misogyny, homophobia, and more specifically for this episode, anti-Semitism. A lot of it correlates to the rise of the alt-right and kind of the after effects of the QAnon and conspiracy theory era. And of course, how it ties into fashion with Kanye West's public mental breakdown, kind of bringing in a lot of those sentiments into the fashion industry and kind of having its own little QAnon moment with Balenciaga as well. So basically, instead of covering the current events, we're going to take a look at one of the most prolific yet underrated instances of anti-Semitism in the fashion industry, which is Miss Coco Chanel's connection to Nazi Germany. Now, before I get into her backstory, Jaden, what are, if you have any, some of the most iconic memories or moments that you associate with the House of Chanel?
When I think of the House of Chanel, when I think of their collections, one of my favorite is like Essay Spring 1992. It was a show with a lot of like cropped blazer sets, a lot of like fun tops. It was a lot of like monogram looks. And monochromatic looks, I would say, which is, I think, what I think about the most when I think about Chanel's like clothing. But besides that, all I think about is like accessories. Yeah. Y'all on like Instagram with your like fake Chanel bags.
Santana, we love Santana, you. We sister. Love you down, sister.
But, and like Karl Lagerfeld, of course, that's yes. Chanel. But besides that, Chanel's not my favorite like brand. So I don't have too many emotions or like thoughts tied to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I mean, I feel like it's kind of like the gateway starter brand for, you know, every fashion enthusiast since Tumblr was around because of those 90s collections and like just how prolific all of those images were on Tumblr. Like, honestly, like those shows birthed the whole generation of fashion lovers. 100%. But like on a personal level, like I've never really cared for it. Of course, like I love like the little cute accessories, and I love like when they do more campier and like brighter collections, but I don't know, I was never like I never really cared about it outside of like looking at pictures of Naomi. Honestly.
The thing about Chanel is it had all the 90s girls, all the 90s fashion girls and models.
Yeah.
That was the most important, because Chanel now, there's, in my opinion, there's nothing like too exciting about Chanel.
No, it's like dreary. Yes, dreary. It's one of those things. It's all of them things. It's sleepy is what it is.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. And then for me, I think like with Carl, I always think of the set designs because of how like cinematic they were. So I always enjoy like beautiful runway imagery like that. But like, current Chanel, like, I don't know. People defend current Chanel, but it's tired. We get it.
It is. But I think they care more so, like, it's the fashion community discussing Chanel.
These suffragette-ass fashions.
This
suffragette fashions. I hate it.
Really, like, I think when I look at Chanel, it looks like it could be, like, costume design for, like, a period piece.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It. For, I don't know, the Marvelous Miss Maisel or whatever that shit is. But it's not for me.
No, not at all. Over it.
What is the creative director?
Virginie Wolf?
Wolf something. Virginia Wolf.
It does look like that. Like, literally.
Bitch, that's her inspiration.
Probably. Sorry, Virginie, for saying your name wrong, but...
Yeah, I'm so sorry to this woman, but...
Yeah, do something better.
Yeah, yeah. So not so personally connected to the Chanel brand, but I do appreciate just, like, I don't know, the fact that it is the fashion titan. Like, you can show the double C logo in any part of the world, and you're gonna know, anyone will know what that brand is. Okay. So, first, let's get into Miss Coco Chanel's early life. So, Gabrielle Chanel was born August 19th, 1883, to Janine Delvaux and Albert Chanel in Saumur, Maine-et-Loire, France. She was the second out of four kids, who essentially would become orphaned after their mother's death in 1895. Her father was still around, but he was a deadbeat and a floozy. So they spent most of their childhood in an orphanage in Osbain, France, under the care of nuns, where she learned a lot of traditional feminine skills like sewing and embroidery. Gabrielle was actually introduced to design by her aunt Louise, who would often visit the Chanel sisters at the orphanage, because Louise enjoyed making hats and restoring old clothes and would often bring Gabrielle to her trips to purchase fabrics.
Question. Would you say that, or how did her like upbringing and like early childhood affect her like design work and creating the Chanel ideal?
So in everything I read, it noted that Gabrielle was very aware of social hierarchies and the importance that aesthetics played in signaling your class status, which is basically a fancy way of saying that since she was a child, she was aware of the fact that she was impoverished and was observant of the fact that like the wealthy girls at the private school that, well, she attended a private school that was run by nuns, and essentially there were charity girls and there were actual wealthy students. The charity girls, what were they called? They were called the necessitis, or the needy girls in the orphanage. And the rich girls were called the payantes. I'm putting a Spanish twist on this French word, and it's just not working out. But essentially, the needy girls wore a very distinct black uniform, and the rich girls wore a slightly like more feminine navy version of the uniform. And that's something that she noted like as a child, which basically was a visual signifier that, you know, you were the poor girl in the ugly clothes.
That hit me in the heart. Because
I've been the impoverished girl in the gray curl in the like gray clothes for sure.
Yeah, that hurt my feelings.
But yeah, and as a child, she also was an avid reader of Pierre de Coulis. Pierre de Coulis novels, in which the heroines took part in tempestuous romances and reversals of social status. So basically the poor girl to rich princess fantasy novels.
She's all that. Like, come on. Still.
I mean, obviously, like, it was a very hard time, and all she basically had was fantasy novels as, you know, an outlet. And then in her 20s, Chanel was hired as a posse, which was basically a really glammed up, beautiful woman who was hired to pose behind a stage performer at this really popular entertainment venue called La Rotonde in Malouns. And in this position, she wore a uniform that consisted of a short sequin black dress, which would then serve as one of the inspirations for the iconic little black dress. This was also where she was given the nickname Coco, based on her rendition of the song Coco Rico. And also it was short for the nickname of a coquette, which is a French-kept woman. Later on in life, Coco was called single-minded and practical in her approach to personal style. Typically, she wore like schoolgirl style attire or menswear. She had a very slim figure and preferred simple clothing that was more androgynous than typical fashions for women at that time.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yes. But, so you can see kind of the like the origins of like everything that she's known for. They started literally from her childhood. So this brand, you know, despite the fact that we're going to learn about, you know, some terrible origins, like genuinely everything that has become the iconography for Chanel came from her experiences as a child.
Makes sense. And so we know she was broke. So how did she fund the business?
Okay, well, she was broke. I mean, to no fault of her own, but that did not stop her. Because while she was working at La Rotonde, Chanel became acquainted with Etienne Balzin, who was a British man who came from a wealthy family of textile manufacturers and equestrians. Basically, this guy invited Chanel and the other coquettes to live with him and his bachelor homeboys at Chateau de Royal. which basically his bachelor pad. She was a sugar baby. She was a sugar. Like, let's cut to the chase. Coco Chanel was a sugar baby and a city girl. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is, while I was writing this episode, honestly, it was like, it was so hard to not root for her while I was reading this part, because you know, I love a rags to riches fantasy.
Like, literally, she had the vision and she like made that shit work.
From the orphanage, she knew what she wanted and she was going to get it. I mean, she put the fascism in fashion, but she got it.
Yeah,
she got it. Etienne invited Chanel and the other coquettes to live with him and his friends at the chateau, where she learned how to ride horses and how to dress attractively and use cosmetics. Chanel was also exploring her interest in millinery, which is the art of hat making. And she would give her designs to the other ladies who lived in the chateau. Eventually, the hats became so popular that Balzin agreed to let Chanel use an apartment he owned in Paris as her first studio. So the dolls are dolling. The divas are divaing. They're divaing. And she low-key invented influencer marketing. And we'll see this later on. But she's like, she's just very aware of basically the power of social networks from a very, very early age, where she would give out these hats to these high society women and basically use, you know, the word of mouth marketing to kick off her hat making business.
Which is smart, since there honestly is no other way to like sell things if you don't have like an actual like notarized like boutique or whatever they had.
Yeah. And at the time, women still couldn't have bank accounts. So, I mean, honestly, the only way to get funding for something like this would be to have a wealthy benefactor.
Yeah.
So, yes. And then the finessing does not stop, because in 1908, Gabrielle struck up a romantic relationship with Arthur Boy Capelta, a wealthy friend of Blasian. So, his name is not Blasian, but we're going to call him Blasian now. He's Blasian now.
The country of Blasia.
The president of the country of Blasia. So not the original sugar the daddy, the friend of the sugar daddy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
She starts a romantic relationship with.
Boyfriend number two.
So boyfriend number two provides Chanel with the initial funding to start her business, in addition to purchasing her first official hat boutique in 1910. And by the end of 1916, Chanel had expanded her line to include women's sportswear, doubled her initial investment, and paid Capel back in full. Period.
No, that's giving. Like, it's like, she's a terrible person, but like, it's giving.
A fascist, but she's doing the damn thing.
Paying back in full, like, that's insane.
Honestly, Kanye could never. Kanye had to get his debts paid back by his white wife.
Oh, skirt. Like, podcast over. I'm cutting it.
Period. That's the end of my thesis statement. Good night. Have a great day. Don't forget episode to like over. And subscribe. Right. Bye.
Honestly, she got it.
Arthur was a really important figure in Coco's life. She actually will go on and name the iconic boy bag after his nickname. And he's actually credited with being the actual inspiration behind the little black dress, because essentially she was her sugar baby throughout the duration of his life. He gets married to another woman. She's still the sugar baby. Mm-hmm. She's dating other people. She's still the sugar baby. And then he dies. I forget the year. I'll drop it in the notes or something. But basically, after he dies, she goes into such a deep depression that she started to only make black dresses. And then they were just so chic and fab that they became the iconic little black dress of the House of Chanel.
Which I understand. I would do that.
Right. Imagine. I mean, honestly, if someone funded my dreams like that, like, I would make a whole collection about them too.
Oh, over every day I'm mentioning their name. It's okay.
Every single bitch, y'all, my man.
Oh, sick of me.
Y'all hoes gonna be sick of me. Some other notable connections that she had. She also dated the Prince of Wales for 10 years. And she had a very intimate relationship with a woman named Vera Bate, who was a British style consultant and model who was cousins with Winston Churchill. And when I say interesting connection, I mean, and they were roommates.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You heard the androgyny. She was getting her little, you know, equestrian butch on or whatever.
She was getting that World War I strap.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I was going to say she was getting her Leighton on, honestly.
Shout out.
Shout out to my girl.
So I know the timeline that we're discussing with Chanel is around like World War I, or maybe even like during that. So how did she continue having a business or even making money when so much is happening in the world?
Yeah, so World War I actually was what kind of made Chanel as a business. Because during the time, some women were finally being afforded the opportunities to take roles on in business, medicine, and like other male-dominated fields. So women could now own businesses and have their own separate bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And Paris high society saw the rise of the quote-unquote new woman, which in America, we consider these like the flapper. This was like the flapper era. And in France, it was called the garçon. I'm saying that right. The garçon. She spent plenty of time outside the home, listening to live jazz, dancing, drinking, watching films, having the audacity to drive vehicles. How dare she? And then also they were defined by the iconic bob cut. And this cultural movement, the B.O.B.
Yeah, you know I'm known for the bob.
The
only thing that came through my head.
Just Santana bobbling his head. Honestly, me and my flapper dress, just bobbling my head.
Yeah, going down the street. Yeah.
Bobbling. This new era was the perfect embodiment of Chanel's style, which focused on creating sporty yet glamorous clothes that moved with women's bodies instead of like in prior high society times. There was a lot of restricting and the layers with all the corsetry and all that pageantry. But due to the lack of resources during World War I, Chanel had to introduce cheaper materials like jersey fabrics and lower end furs to her collections, which surprisingly did not like impact demand or price in a way that you would typically think. In 1915, a Chanel jersey dress sold for 7,000 francs, which in current day would be around $3,700 for a jersey knit dress. Bonker. I mean, if you think about it, I think prices now for a Chanel dress.
Oh, yes.
I know, because I feel like you can get some for around like 150 to like 3,000.
Yes, but that is also today because Chanel the brand. Even though back then she was like becoming popular, she still was not like widely known.
This was 1915.
Like household name like that. So people buying that and being able to afford that was wild, especially during like World War I.
Mm-hmm. And what I thought was really interesting was the fact that she introduced the use of imitation jewels, and she actually wore fake pearls with her own real ones, which I mean the pearls are again one of the most iconic like signifiers of the Chanel brand, and the fact that like she didn't really see the personal value in like the actual real ones, and suggesting that there's a degree of like interchangeability between the real luxury and the fake luxury. I I, again, she's not a great person, but I do kind of respect the come up and the finesse of saying, like, yeah, I have this audience. Yeah, I serve this class of people, but I'm a scammer. Like, I came from the bottom. Smart. It's not really a real difference. If I can pull off a look, it don't matter the price.
No. And I agree with that because I'm a person, I don't care about authenticity when it comes to jewelry or like a diamond or pearl. As long as it looks like something and it's like pretty enough.
Can you carry it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how you carry it.
And can it abstain? Like, is it going to break in 2 days? If it's not, I will rock this like fake little metal and fake little pearl till I die.
Yep. Which is interesting. I mean, that's interesting because that's coming from like our perspective as like middle class people. We still have like a degree of privilege, but like obviously not to this extent. But on the other side, the wealthy women saw it as an opportunity to wear expensive clothing, but with more ease and like an understated elegance. They actually had a term for it. It was called miserabilisme deluxe. Miserabilisme deluxe, which essentially is luxurious poverty. So she kind of invented the concept of, I mean, she did invent the concept of high-low luxury or high-low chic.
Fashion Nova jeans with your like Louis Vuitton heels.
Hello. With my plastic Chanel boy bag.
Yep. Got it.
Okay. So yeah, essentially by the end of World War I, Chanel was a bona fide success. She said, quote, "The first war made me in 1997. I woke up famous." And by the early 30s, Chanel had amassed a fortune of 15 million francs, which is around $9 million in today's money. And she was employing around 4,000 workers. So basically, like, across the world, across industry, war helps the interest of capitalism and capital owners. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, that's you can still get your luxury goods off in the middle of a world war.
I think all when like the world is in some type of mourning or like in trouble, that always happens because we haven't had a large world war in a minute, but lockdown
in a minute.
In a minute. But lockdown, we saw how many businesses and like brands that created.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of similar to that.
Yeah, and we also saw the billionaire class more than double their net worth while, you know, the entire rest of the world suffered. So unfortunately, not much has changed. So that's basically how the business of Chanel was established. Now that we got that out of the way, we are going to take a short break and be right back to discuss World War II and her Nazi connections. Did I say that right? So World War II began in September 1939 after Britain and France declared war on Germany after Hitler's invasion of Poland. At the time, Coco was living at the Ritz Hotel in the then German-occupied Paris, where she struck up a relationship with a German intelligence operative named Hans Gunther von Dinklage, which is a cartoon villain name if I have ever heard it.
Literally, I really just started thinking about, you know, from the Fairly Odd Parents, like the Dinkelbergs.
Dinkelbergs, yeah.
No offense to y'all, anyone with German heritage, not trying to laugh at y'all, but...
Yeah, we need to laugh through the trauma of this next session because it's going to get dicey.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Dinklage was a Gestapo spy and a major asset to the Abwehr. He was a Gestapo spy and a major asset to the Abwehr, which was the Nazi intelligence or spy organization. Allegedly, Michonnel also participated in the plundering of unoccupied Jewish houses. There was an account by two wealthy Parisian sisters. Essentially, their former chauffeur drove Chanel and, quote, a German officer who was her lover to an abandoned home of a wealthy Jewish family, where she then walked around the house and gave the chauffeur a list of items that she wanted sent to her. So she was deep in it.
Deep in it like a spy. Was she doing like missions?
Apparently, you know, whatever Dinklage was doing was working, because Chanel did become a spy. It is not well documented, but we do have proof that she participated in one, possibly two operations for Nazi Germany. So the first mission revolved around the release of her nephew, Andrew Plessé. He was actually a fighter in the French army. He got captured and was sent to a prisoner of war camp. And despite the fact that, like, Chanel wasn't really close to her remaining family, like, she was very fond of this particular nephew. So in the summer of 1941, Dinklage and Chanel organized a deal for the release of Andre in exchange for communication with some of Chanel's powerful allied connection. With her boyfriend's help, Chanel and a colleague of Dinklage would travel together to Madrid, which was in neutral Spain, where Chanel would then, quote, make a trip to England so that she could give her important friends economic and political information. We don't actually know, like, many details aside from the fact that the trip occurred. We don't know what the information was, who she was talking to, but Andre was released in the winter of 1941. So apparently the mission was successful.
She was doing something that worked.
And noted that it was her allied connections. There are thoughts. Some people think that it was Winston Churchill, because she did have that connection with him through her roommate. So that is the prevalent theory. But no paperwork, no evidence, no further details has ever been found.
That is so... I was about to say shout out to her, then I realized she was doing stuff for the Nazis, so I'm going to take that back. Recant. Right. Redacted.
Recant. Because, yeah. I mean, and again, it's just like, it's so hard to, like, separate the person from the finesse. Because I respect finesse overall. And the one thing that she had was finesse. She had anti-Semitism. She had fascism. She had great style, and she had finesse.
Yeah. She was a person. I was about to say, I can't even compliment her. She was just a person. That's all I'm going to say.
She was a human being.
Yeah.
But not enough finesse to not get caught, which is why we know about these Nazi connections in the first place. So the second operation, which was called Operation Model Hut, you want to guess what that means, what that's German for?
No, just tell me.
Yes. Based on her history and the
model hut, it mean like locking up a model because she was a fashion designer? What does it mean?
No, it means model's hat in German.
Oh.
Because remember, she started out as a hat maker.
I feel stupid, but okay.
I mean, she was leaving the breadcrumbs from the beginning.
Yeah, literally.
She was deep in it. So this operation was an attempt by Chanel and Dinklage to broker a secret peace agreement between Winston Churchill and Heinrich Himmler, who was the leader of the SS, which is Hitler's private army. Winston Churchill was well known for being pro-German towards the end of the war, along with many other senior British politicians. Basically, they were so afraid of communism that the leaders were afraid that the Soviet Union would gain control over all of Europe. And essentially, the Duke encouraged Chanel to act as an emissary between Berlin and London in an effort to kind of still maintain some of Germany's democratic influences in like the Reconstruction era. But again, Chanel was not a professional spy. So she brought along her old friend that I mentioned, Vera Bate Lombardi, who was cousins with Churchill. But she claimed the trip was to scout out a new Chanel boutique in Madrid. So she did not disclose what the intent was to Vera. The plan actually goes wrong quickly when Bate realized what the true purpose of the trip was, and Vera actually goes and confesses to the authorities upon leaving Madrid and implicates Chanel. The French government actually arrests Chanel after the liberation of Paris in 1944, but she was released after only a few several hours of interrogation due to lack of physical evidence. It is suspected that the release was orchestrated by Churchill because Chanel was aware that he violated the Treating with the Enemy Act, which he actually penned, by secretly paying the Nazis to protect the Duke of Windsor's property in Paris. Unfortunately, Miss Vera got the short end of the stick. And she was detained for nearly a year afterwards and was only released after it came to light that Chanel had deceived her.
Chanel did not care about no one. She really didn't.
She was ruthless. She threw her lesbian lover under the bus for her German Nazi boyfriend.
Well, which is so interesting to me how that happened, because Vera was Churchill's like what, cousin or something?
Cousin.
He didn't want to help her.
Well, Chanel had the dirt on Churchill, so yeah. It's either my reputation or my cousin, and he picked his reputation.
Okay. Am I surprised? No, but still very disgusting and sad.
Mm-mm. He said, "I'm throwing that lesbian under the bus too."
Saying no gay rights.
Right, no gay rights for y'all.
Okay, yeah. So we know like Chanel. So we know Coco Chanel was like working with the Nazis, but was she actually anti-Semitic, or was she just there hanging out, like just passively there?
Just chilling, you know, digmatized, doing whatever.
Whatever.
So. It's interesting because in a lot of her biographies, she's referred to as like a passive participant, basically like as a Catholic person being raised in France at the time, there was just a lot of anti-Semitism and she was kind of just going along with the common political rhetoric. And that's one theory, that she was kind of a passive participant. But the other more interesting theory is that she actually got screwed out of a lot of money, and that kind of spurred the anti-Semitic sentiments because it was a personal beef.
Okay.
So essentially, in the early 1920s, Chanel developed her first fragrance, the iconic Chanel No. 5, which would eventually become like the cornerstone of her brand all the way up into present day. It attracts customers from wealthy, middle-class backgrounds. Everybody knows Chanel No. 5.
Yeah.
So 3 years after the official launch of the perfume, French perfume magnates Pierre and Paul Werthmeyer arranged a deal with Chanel to significantly expand the production and distribution of Chanel No. 5. The deal establishes a perfume company called Parfums Chanel. And because Chanel did not want to be involved in the company's operations, she agreed to accept 10% of the company's profits, while the brothers received 70% as compensation for production, marketing, and distribution. During World War II, while Chanel Couture and like the main Chanel boutiques were shut down, due to the German occupation of France, the perfume company actually remained open and maintained its status as one of the most successful fragrances in the world. And this led to Chanel coming to regret the terms of the original contract and feeling cheated out of the profits because the brothers were of Jewish origin. And so during the time, she sought to regain control from the Werthmeyer brothers by invoking Nazi laws that prohibited Jewish ownership of business. But the brothers had already transferred the ownership of the company to a non-business Jewish man named Felix Almut in 1939, stopping Chanel's attempts to reclaim control of perfumes Chanelica.
Not gonna lie.
Get into this, because at the end of the day, ownership of capital and the pursuit of wealth is above all, despite the fact that this woman was a out and out anti-Semite who wanted to get her business back. The Werthmeyer brothers actually backed Chanel again when she relaunched her business in 1954. And today, Alan and Gerard Werthmeyer, who are the direct descendants of the Werthmeyer brothers, co-own the $32 billion brand that their grandfathers first invested in.
That was a good deal. Shout out to them. But
okay.
What I was gonna say is, just as you were reading like the details of that of the original agreement, I was like, that don't make no damn sense. That 70-10, I said, that don't make no damn sense. No matter what.
Yeah.
Like, I know, well, I think I know what she was like looking at and thinking what would happen, but I was like, girl.
Right. I mean, it was 70-10. I think 20% went to like a business consultant who like actually paired them together. But like, I don't know. Cause at that point you can't even say it's like negligence. Like, she was already a successful businesswoman who already overcame so much. Like, she overcame not being able to legally be a business owner. So like, there's no sympathy for me. Like, you agreed to those terms.
Yeah, you did that. So now you're like, oh, it also, you know, bringing back to present day, is very like Kanye being like, a Jewish doctor diagnosed me.
Lord,
so all Jewish people suck.
Right.
That there's doesn't make sense.
Right. There's like, it's just amazing to me that like people are seeing it as like a religious or cultural thing, when if you just take a step back, it's all about who owns what capital and how one human being is fucking over another human being in the pursuit of capital. And you can even see how the pursuit of capital will have people going against their personal interests, because at the end of the day, the brothers went back and backed Chanel again and made, you know, quadrupled, quadrilled, whatever, for this pursuit of profit. Like, that's all it is. Like, they were, you know, afforded the opportunity. Essentially, what I'm trying to say is the only reason the brothers were protected from what the Nazis were doing and the Aryan laws was because they were capital owners. And at the end of the day, people who own capital will align themselves with other people who own capital before people of cultural or like, you know, racial backgrounds. At the end of the day, they're always going to choose other wealthy people over their other quote unquote perceived communities.
Yeah. And that's a big thing we see in like, not just fashion and all like businesses and capital owners like you talk about, but it is, while it makes sense, it's also gross.
It's the same old song and dance.
Always, it never
ends. Maybe it's time for big sexy socialism. Just an idea.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. So bringing it back to like Chanel, because I do have like a question. So we know that's what she was doing during World War II, but like obviously she didn't get in prison. So what happened after World War II when all the Nazis were, you know, free flying, they out, they in trouble?
Yeah. So basically in the fallout of World War II, her interrogation wasn't made public I mean, most likely because there were so many other public villains and there just wasn't much public interest. And then by the mid-1950s, Chanel was back designing again and building Chanel into the Chanel we know now. She died peacefully at the Ritz in 1970 with only minor blemishes to her social status.
Yeah.
So really not a lot of public repercussions, essentially no business repercussions. And the brand itself essentially just ignored it for years and years and years until more people started delving into her history. And there's a couple biographies that I use as references that I will cite in the episode notes. And basically that publicity kind of forced the brand to acknowledge it. And the last statement that I found from the company comes from a Forbes quote in 2020, where a spokesperson told Forbes, Gabrielle Chanel was a daring pioneer and the House of Chanel upholds and extends her extraordinary legacy. Her influence on many designers has been significant and she continues to inspire new generations. However, her actions during World War II are the subject of discussion in many publications and biographies. The actions that some have reported in no way represent the values of Chanel today. Since that time in history, the House of Chanel has moved forward well beyond the past of its founder. So they said, bitch, don't ask me about no stupid shit.
Literally, that is the dumbest statement, the most, like, they didn't mention
anything. Girl, don't ask me about no old shit.
Like, that's an old bitch. I don't know her. This is the right. New girl.
Ain't no miles on this here new body, bitch. We don't know who that hoe is.
I think that is the dumbest statement ever. There's like no real, obviously, like Chanel now is, she's dead. Like Coco Chanel is dead. So it has,
yeah, rest in piss.
Rest in piss.
Go piss rest girl. In piss, bitch. Go piss, go girl. Piss girl.
But there's no, like, they never use the word like anti-Semitism in that statement. They never talked about
it's nothing.
No, right, like racism or even like any of the horrible things that she was doing. So if you're not mentioned, like, there's no apology. I mean, they, or even, you don't have to apologize, but there's no exact confrontation to the issues. It's very vague.
And there's no acknowledgement.
If something's too vague, then you might as well have not said anything, I feel.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's like the sad truth of it. It doesn't matter because this information is public and it's been public for years and years and years. And if that was something that society deemed a punishable offense, it would have been happened.
Yeah.
At this point.
I agree with that.
But yeah, that is the history of Miss Gabrielle Coco Chanel and her ties to Nazi Germany.
I hope you learned. Wait, what? Hold on. What are we trying to say here?
I don't know.
Wrapping it up.
That was just me. Like that. She did it. She done did the thing.
Yeah. That's it.
She's sucking Nazi. Sorry, that was not nice.
That was aggressive.
No, she was sucking Nazi. I don't give a.
No, just like, it was so aggressive. I was like, ooh, jump scare. Like,
I'm tired of talking about this.
Honestly, I do have a question for, not just for you, but for like our audience. I mean, you can tell us this, you know, and after you listen to this, you know, reply to us on Instagram, all over the place. But knowing this information about Coco Chanel, does this change your opinion about the brand and your like decisions to go out and buy like a little Chanel pet purse for your mama?
I mean, I get a plastic one from AliExpress, but that's about it. Yeah. If someone wants to buy me one, I'm open to it, but I don't know if it's coming out of my wallet.
Yeah. It could also be because I don't really care about Chanel anyways. You know, even though like the City Girl said they want double CCs, I don't care. And that's all.
We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back to close out the episode.
Boom, 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 boom.
Do the homeless like Prada?
Yes, queen!
And we're back and ready to close out this episode. But first, we have a couple of announcements, a couple of new updates and scheduling things coming to Sample Size Media and Schmample Schmaj Podcast. So, Jaden, would you like to make the announcement?
Here we go, everyone. So, starting off with this episode, you can expect weekly podcast episodes every Monday or maybe Wednesday if we don't get that out in time. But Monday or Wednesday, you'll hear from us weekly. We'll be doing like seasonal. Oh, that's not a word.
Seasonal?
Seasonal. I was like seasonal. Yep. Yep. Seasonal. I'm taking our podcast season by season. And we're really excited. We have a whole bunch of like fun content for this first season as we're coming back.
Yes. 2023. We are coming back. Consistent, but also realistic. So you can expect new episodes on Mondays, most weeks, and Wednesdays when we are depressed.
You know, now we are working with like an editor. So maybe that'll like
up in the budget, up in the production value.
We still have to hit post ourselves though. So that you can't rely on us too much.
And if you would like more fashion posts, mostly unhinged shit posting, I'm not going to lie, you can follow us on TikTok and Instagram for more content. And that is Sample Size Media on both platforms. If you're interested in finding out more information about this episode and reading some of the reference links, that will all be in the show notes and on the blog post. So definitely follow us on social media, turn on post notifications, and what else?
And you also can follow both of us personally on both of our pages to get a little bit more of our personal mess. What's your handle, Noelle?
I am Noelle WTF. That is Noelle.WTF on Instagram. On TikTok, Stiff Socks, a lot of C's, but I will update that to be Noelle WTF, and I'll post it on my Instagram.
What did
I said? Stiff Socks. That's my TikTok name.
Okay. I'm gonna let you have
it. I don't know. Well, I don't know. It was a spam page, okay? And I haven't changed my username yet. Leave me alone. What are your socials, ma'am?
You can follow me on Instagram at Jaden_Wash. That is JADAN_Wash. At Jaden on Instagram, I'm still coming for you. Answer my DMs. I want that handle. Anyway. And you can follow me on Instagram at just JadenWash. No. Ooh, I meant TikTok. You can follow me on TikTok at just Jaden Wash.
And do not forget to subscribe to us on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast. Leave a comment, leave a review, leave 5 stars. Share us on your Instagram. We appreciate it. And we want to keep growing our little community of size queens.
Yeah. Is that what we're calling them? Size queens?
is that what we're going to call our family, the size queens? I kind of like that.
I don't like that at all. No. I don't like that at all. Also, you know what? Tell us on Instagram how you feel about being called size queens. I know.
Yeah, we'll put up a poll.
I know some of y'all already call yourselves size queens. If you know, you know. That's why I said I don't like that title. But, you know, the dusty bottoms.
We'll put it up to a vote. This is a socialist podcast, so we'll have the people decide.
All right, yeah. All right, we'll do that. Let us know.
All righty. Bye. Bye.
Alana, do the homeless like Prada?
Yes, queen.